Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. WFSU FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The fallout continues from high-profile cases of sexual harassment in the legislature.
The culture that's up here, it needs to change, and this bill needs to pass, and we're dedicated to making sure that happens.
We get a broader look at how the media covers such cases and how that's changing in the wake of the Me Too movement.
It is so rare in American journalism to hear the voice of a sexual assault survivor.
And a federal court has ruled Florida's process for restoring the voting rights of felons is unconstitutional. That's amid a larger push to automatically restore those rights after they complete their sentences. I'm Lynn Hatter in for Tom Flanagan, and you're listening to Capitol Report. Welcome to tonight's show. Reform-minded Florida lawmakers are having some disagreements over how to address sexual harassment. House Republicans have significantly expanded their measure. Kate Payne reports that could make it more difficult for the two chambers to find agreement.
Senator Lauren Book and Representative Kristen Jacobs agreed on how to address Florida's sexual harassment problem. Ban it outright in the state's ethics code, increase penalties for violators, and set up a task force to make sure the reforms continue. But House Republicans want to expand on that. Here's co-sponsor Eustace Republican Jennifer Sullivan.
It requires supervisors who observe or have direct knowledge of sexual harassment to respond promptly and initiate required actions. It ensures the confidentiality of witnesses and subjects of harassment. Requires employee and public officer training, requires suspected criminal conduct be promptly reported to law enforcement.
The bill would affect lawmakers, their staff, and other employees, lobbyists, and Capitol visitors. The measure would also make agencies set workplace dating policies. And there are some protections for the accused, too. Here's Sullivan again.
One who makes a reporting to a public office that is intentionally false or maliciously made with reckless disregard for the truth or identity of the subject of the harassment or harasser commits a misdemeanor of the second degree.
House lawmakers, led by Speaker Corcoran, tacked all these measures onto a pre-existing bill regulating lobbyists. The chambers will have to work out those differences if they're going to get it passed. Senator Book and Representative Jacobs say they'll get on the same page.
And I think that really everybody wants to do what's best for the people. So I don't think that anything's insurmountable.
I would totally agree with that.
But the bill has to pass, says Jacobs.
The culture that's up here, it needs to change, and this bill needs to pass, and we're dedicated to making sure that happens.
She's fired up for a reason. Allegations of sexual misconduct have rocked the state house. Media reports have detailed affairs, harassment, coercion, and assault in the state capitol. Senate Appropriations Chairman Jack Latvala resigned and is under investigation by the FDLE. There's probable cause that he forced a then-lobbyist into a sexual relationship in exchange for votes. That woman is now a legislative aide to Senator Lauren Book. So it's personal. Here's the plantation Democrat in a committee hearing.
Mr. Chairman, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to present this bill today. And I say us because I stand before you, as I said, for a lot of folks. And so I want to thank you for you and the committee for giving us this time and giving us this day. This is the first step, and this has meant a lot to a lot of people.
As it stands now, legislative leaders have the power to resolve some of these issues internally. Lawmakers, staff, and lobbyists can have complicated relationships. Without an independent investigator leading the way, there could be room for bias. But Jacob says, first things first.
We recognize we're not going to get it right on the first shot out. This problem has evolved over decades, and it's a culture that needs to change. And change, while we wish it would happen overnight, it doesn't always happen with the stroke of a pen and a new bill.
In the meantime, both bills are moving through the process. And the issue is really resonating with some politicos. Attorney General Pam Bondi personally came to a Senate committee meeting to pledge her support, which is pretty rare. And Miami Beach Democratic Representative David Richardson talked about his own experiences with harassment, something he'd never done before in public.
You know, everyone knows that I'm an openly gay man, but there was a time in my life where I didn't want people to know that I was gay because I thought it would hurt my career. And in my first job, I was an auditor, and there was a young straight female coworker who every day teased and taunted me of my sexual orientation.
Richardson says there are many kinds of harassment and many kinds of harassers. He hopes his colleagues will remember that. The Senate bill has two more committee stops left. The House version is ready for a floor vote. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Sexual assault survivors are speaking out more and more, from the Me Too movement to the heart-wrenching testimony of 150 young women who testified at the sentencing hearing of USA Gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar. The media has been covering more and more of these cases where survivors of sexual assault are speaking out publicly. Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute for Media Studies says while media reports traditionally left victims anonymous, that may be changing. WUSF's Mary Shedden spoke with McBride. This interview begins with testimony from some of Nassar's victims.
I saw you from the time I was 14 until then.
I was 11 years old when I first went to see Larry.
I was 7 years old.
I was only 12.
I had been his patient since I was 8 years old.
The pain you have caused me mentally and emotionally is unexplainable.
Those are just a few of the 150 sexual assault victims who spoke out at the sentencing of USA Gymnastics' Larry Nassar. Kelly, those voices, which we heard from the podcast The Daily, they aren't typical.
No, it is so rare in American journalism to hear the voice of a sexual assault survivor. Most of that is because traditionally sexual assault survivors' names are kept anonymous to spare them the stigma and shame.
But we're seeing this happening more. Why is that?
Well, I think it's the culmination of a bunch of different things. If you look at the coverage of the Bill Cosby story and then the coverage of the Harvey Weinstein story, and that all leading to the Me Too moment where we started talking about sexual harassment and assault in the workplace, that's one factor. But in addition to that, what I see among the younger generation of sexual assault survivors is a rejection of the stigma and shame that society puts on them. And that's mainly because through the internet, they can connect with each other and tell their stories in alternative forums. And that gives them the power and the confidence to reject those societal judgments.
Recently, a young Tampa woman, she published a video on YouTube, and she alleged sexual abuse at the hands of a doctor she had worked for. A lot of media did quick hit stories about the fallout of that case. How does that case stack up about how you see media covering sexual assault?
The stories that I've seen so far covering that case fall very much into the traditional version of how journalists tell the story. And that's because they're motivated by a public safety imperative. As journalists, we think, oh, we have to let people know that this happened so that they can protect themselves. But if you play that out a little bit further, those stories really do very little to help families protect their children or their loved ones from sexual assault, because all it does is tell you about one possible case.
Is there another way to tell the story then?
If journalists considered sexual assault a public health problem, they would tell the story in a very different way.
How so?
If you look at the cases of Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein, you see that because those subjects were so powerful, journalists didn't report the story until they were relatively certain that they knew exactly what had happened. They had a lot of sources lined up, and they'd done deep, deep investigation into it. So I would recommend to editors that they don't cover cases of sexual assault unless they're going to spend a lot of resources to figure out what happened.
Do you see anybody doing that?
The way we got to Larry Nassar's sentencing started with an investigative report by the Indianapolis Star. Their target was USA Gymnastics and a number of coaches who had been reported to law enforcement but kept coaching. That story eventually turned up the very first victim to come forward publicly and say that Dr. Nassar assaulted her. And then hundreds and hundreds of other girls came forward. I hope that newsrooms will continue to devote investigative resources to this really important story.
Still to come on Capitol Report, legislative leaders say they're closer than usual on a spending total for their budget plans this year. But it starts to look farther apart if you dig into the details.
There are a lot of very, very substantive differences between how the two sides have chosen to spend that $87 billion plus.
And Canada and Florida share more in common than just snowbirds, at least when it comes to climate change.
It's looking at the technologies that you use, your way of designing cities, the way you think about the future.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org.
You're listening to Capitol Report. I'm Lynn Hatter. Welcome back. On Thursday, U.S. District Judge Mark Walker declared Florida's process of restoring felons' civil rights unconstitutional. Walker criticized the, quote, absolute veto authority Governor Rick Scott has on the process, and he has ordered a permanent remedy be in place by February 12th. Andrew Quintana recently sat with Program Director for Florida State University's Center for the Advancement of Human Rights, Mark Schlackman. The two talk about Florida's current restoration process and what changes Governor Scott and his cabinet, which make up the State Clemency Board, can make by the deadline.
How does Florida's process for restoring those rights work compared to other states?
Basically, the rules that were adopted in March of 2011 require 5 and 7 year waiting periods, and but that does not mean that people would necessarily regain their civil rights. But here, just to put this in order of magnitude, the Department of Corrections indicates in excess of 60,000 people complete sentences for felony convictions in the state of Florida. So simple math. You do, quick math, 60,000 a year. Since 2011, when these new, more highly restrictive rules were implemented, from that point forward to October 27 of this past year, 2017, the total number of civil rights restoration, voting rights restorations granted, 2,807. Here's the implication. This is a rapidly expanding population of U.S. citizens, essentially tertiary U.S. citizens, that have absolutely no voice in their government. It's a democratic anomaly.
U.S. District Judge Mark Walker said it's unconstitutional, the process. What if that is unconstitutional? He says it violates the First and 14th Amendment. How does it violate those two?
So in this instance, the basis of the claim has to be necessarily the extent or lack thereof of cases, applications granted over the course of the past several years. Yes, there's a process in place, but if, as I told you, from the inauguration day of the current governor and cabinet in their first term to October 27 of 2017, that there were only 2,807 civil rights restorations granted, voting rights restorations granted, you know, people are saying that's really almost non-existent.
How does this affect the upcoming citizen-led ballot initiative, which restores felons' voting rights once they serve their time? Is this just a waiting game until Governor Scott's term is complete?
It's interesting because the court, and not to suggest what the court is inclined to do, but it would not be unreasonable for the court to at least monitor and be aware of these circumstances and how they may bear upon the underlying issue, because if hypothetically the Citizens Initiative were to pass by at least 60%, the required number percentage to amend the state constitution, that arguably would or could moot out the claim.
Correct.
Now, if they're on the same ballot, interestingly enough, a new governor and I mean, this isn't speculative. A new governor and cabinet will be elected.
Right.
It's unclear who that will be and what their approach to these issues would be, but it's conceivable that that new governor and cabinet could reconsider the current policy.
Mm-hmm.
That also could moot out the underlying claim.
All right. Well, thank you for coming, Mark. Thank you for your time.
As the midpoint of the legislative session nears, the outline of next year's budget is beginning to take shape. Regan McCarthy has more.
The House and Senate have both passed spending plans out of their appropriation committees and are expected to take the measures up on their respective floors as early as next week. The two budgets are considered close, with just $100 million difference between them and an approximately $87 billion spending plan. But Senate Appropriations Chair Rob Bradley says upon closer inspection, the two plans start to look farther apart.
There are a lot of very, very substantive differences between how the two sides have chosen to spend that $87 billion plus.
One of the areas where the two plans differ is member projects. Bradley says the two chambers have allocated largely the same amount of money to the category. Though the numbers show the Senate is spending more, the House plan gives more money per project. Bradley warned senators about the potential impact of that during a floor session.
So we're spending the same amount of money, give or take, on local projects, but we have about twice as many local projects, just spending a little less on each of them across the board. Than the House does. What does that mean? That means that in order to finish our work, there will be necessarily less local projects than in the Senate budget right now.
That's got lawmakers working to hustle their projects, such as funding for beach restoration or matching money for wastewater work, into the House and Senate budget proposals. And Senate President Joe Negron says that's how the process is supposed to work.
I'm pleased that House members and senators are taking seriously their obligation to write the budget, and that I think this is something that we should be proud of. We're the appropriators in the Constitution. We shouldn't leave that up to agencies on Capitol Circle to decide how all the money is distributed throughout the state. It should be transparent and open, but I think it's perfectly appropriate for elected representatives to advocate for projects in their community that will make the state better.
But Negron says he wants to ensure the process for picking which local initiatives get funding is fair.
What I would like to see is the two appropriations chairs agree on a number of this is, given the size of our budget, given what money we have available, this is a reasonable number to spend on member projects or local initiatives, whatever term you want to use. And then once that amounts agreed to, then have that amount divided up fairly between the House and equally between the House and the Senate.
Some other differences between the two spending plans include differences in education spending, a $600 million gap in higher ed in particular. While the Senate would spend more money on higher education, the House is focused on K-12 education. There are also significant differences in how the House and Senate would fund hospitals and care for elderly patients, as well as some difference on how much the chambers are proposing to put toward environmental projects like cleaning up springs. House Speaker Richard Corcoran says deciding how to allocate is simply a matter of picking priorities.
It's just a prioritization, you know. We got to fund our law enforcement. We have to fund our K-12 system. The Senate's putting a great emphasis on funding the higher educational system.
Meanwhile, new state revenue estimates are expected to be released February 9th. What that forecast says could have a significant impact on any upcoming budget talks. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
If Florida lawmakers don't do anything policy-wise soon, the state's prison population could start increasing again. As Sasha Cordner reports, that's according to a report commissioned by the Florida Senate to promote the need for prison reform.
The report is called Data-Driven Solutions to Improve Florida's Criminal Justice System. Len Engel is the director of policy and campaigns with the Crime and Justice Institute.
Last spring, the Crime and Justice Institute worked on a project managed by OPAGA that analyzed criminal justice data from the DOC and from the court system. In that analysis, we found that the Florida Department of Correction, the prison population in Florida, had grown exponentially in the past 40 years, 373% since the late 1970s, finally leveling off in around 2010 at around 102,000 people incarcerated.
The Institute's report found Florida's prisoner population has fluctuated around the 100,000 mark during the past decade. In the last couple years, incarceration has been on the decline. As of last year, more than 96,000 people were in Florida's prisons. Engel says the recent decline can be attributed to the reduction in low-level offenders going to prison, as well as the Florida Department of Corrections putting procedures in place to assist those on probation. Still, Engel says even with the drop, two factors have largely offset those efforts.
First is lengths of sentence, and the second is the amount of time people serve on these sentences. So if most states experience the similar declines in their admitted population, the number of people coming into the prison, you'd see much more significant reductions in the overall prison population. But you haven't in Florida because sentence lengths have increased 22%, and the amount of time served on those sentences has also increased.
Now, the Institute is proposing several recommendations for Florida's prisons using data from other states with similar issues.
The research shows us a handful of fairly clear findings. One, sending low-level offenders to prison is more likely to increase their criminal behavior. Second, longer prison terms, especially for nonviolent offenders, do not reduce recidivism more than shorter terms of incarceration. Third, treatment programs delivered in the community are more effective than treatment programs delivered in prison.
St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis had asked for the study to be commissioned. He says he's already come away with ideas from the recommendations.
At least three or four of these recommendations could be implemented this year. I think specifically felony thresholds is being discussed this year. Conditional medical release is being discussed this year. Those who are suffering from terminal illness being addressed this year. Diversion being addressed this year, largely drug courts, veterans courts. All of those types of diversion discussions are happening this year. More electronic monitoring and technology are being discussed this year.
Yet, Brandis says some proposals could take some time.
We're in the process of kind of ranking these recommendations and saying, all right, what are the low-hanging fruit here that we can begin to address? And I think we're already well into session and addressing many of these recommendations. But I think over the next 4 or 5 years, you're going to see us begin to implement many of these recommendations and have the data to support them and be able to get the legislators comfortable with those solutions.
Brandis has already sponsored several measures he's hoping will reform Florida's criminal justice system. Some bills have already passed their first House and Senate committees. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
And finally tonight, South Florida could see 2 feet of sea level rise in the next 40 years, according to a joint projection by Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Monroe counties. It's frightening to imagine. But that threat does have a benefit. It's led to South Florida being recognized as a global expert on preparation for climate change. And that's even though we're in a state and a country where many officials don't acknowledge climate issues. Recently, Canada's Minister for the Environment and Climate Change was in Miami. WLRN's Kate Stein spoke with Minister Catherine McKenna.
When I started my job, I was immediately in the Paris negotiations. And working very closely with the U.S. administration. Clearly, the new administration federally has taken a different approach to climate change. And so we're now very committed to working with states and cities and businesses in the United States who have stepped up, who've said climate change is real, and we all need to be acting together. In Canada, we're a very large country. We have the largest coastline in the world, including in the high Arctic. So some of the things you do here won't be applicable. But it's looking at, things that you're doing that are smart.
Within South Florida and Miami specifically, what are some of the ideas or technologies that you feel we can offer Canada or Canada can offer South Florida?
Well, I think it's just looking at how you build and how you're adapting to the impacts of climate change. We know with the King Tides that there's a lot of flooding. With climate change, the sea level rise will have a huge impact on Miami. It's looking at the technologies that you use, your way of designing cities, the way you think about the future and modeling for resilient cities in the future.
Can you tell me a little bit more about how you came into the role that you have? Is it a new position?
So I'm the First Minister of the Environment and Climate Change. And that was a clear message by the Prime Minister that we were taking a different tack from the previous government. The previous government would not talk about climate change. It wasn't a word that those words were not allowed to be used in my department. I was in my job for 2 days and then was sent to the Paris climate negotiations. So it was a steep learning curve. And then I had to come home to Canada and get a climate plan. And that was hard because we had a government for 10 years that had done nothing. But we worked really hard with provinces. We worked with businesses. We worked with environmentalists. We worked with Indigenous peoples. And we were able to get a Made in Canada climate plan. And we know we're moving to a cleaner future.
It sounds like part of what changed between the previous administration and the current one in Canada is that there's more of an understanding of the connection between the environment and the economy.
The first change was we looked at science. We decided that we would make decisions based on science and evidence. And the science on climate change is extremely clear. Climate change is real. It's man-made. And if we don't take action, we're going off a cliff. So that was the first thing. But the second thing is, yes, we understand that it's not an and or, that you do the environment and the economy suffers, or you do the, you focus on the economy and the environment suffers. That's not the way it is in today. It's now about doing the right thing for the environment, which also creates good jobs. And even here in Miami, I'm going to see some really cool designs, including Canadian companies that have looked at clean solutions and clean technologies. So that's really the opportunity.
So at the G7 summit that's coming up, Canada is hosting. And you mentioned that one of the focus areas will be the oceans. How is that relevant to your relationship with the United States and with South Florida?
Well, I mean, look, we're Canada and the U.S. are surrounded by oceans, and so we need to be working together. I think even for some folks that have a hard time talking about climate change, everyone can agree that we need to deal with coastal resilience, that we need to build more resilient cities. So I think that's an area that we could come together with the United States, states like Florida, like Texas, that have had to address pretty severe impacts from hurricanes. We're all in this together. And so I'm happy to work with whomever wants to take action on climate change and also recognizes the economic opportunity for good jobs for middle class.
All right. Thank you very much, Minister McKenna.
Thank you very much.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Lynn Hatter. Tom Flanagan will be back next week. Join us each night for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.